I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Curzon Film Podcast. This week we're talking about Wes Anderson's Isle of Dogs. I'm Jake Cunningham, and joining me this week is the Woodford Wolfhound, Sam Howlett.
Who told you I was called that?
I don't know. It just came, like, I know you're your friends from school, yeah. And the Swedish Valhund of Swindon, Beth Webb.
Thank you. What an introduction. Yeah. Actually, the number of people that hear me say Swindon and think Sweden is quite huge. Yeah. So that's, thank you for tapping into that.
Yeah, so we're very happy to welcome Beth onto the show. She has been on a long time ago, but she's back now. And she's a film journalist and programmer for the Bechdel Test Fest, who I'm sure you know, as well as being a multi-platform editor for Random Acts. And not only that, but if you pick up an edition of the Curzon magazine in all of your local Curzons, you can actually find Beth's piece on Isle of Dogs. It's like we planned it.
Almost.
It was my debut. It was my Curzon magazine debut, and it was an absolute honour. So
I read it last
you.
Night at work.
Oh, it's very wonderful. Good. I mean, you should have been working at work.
Should have been working. Yeah, there's a massive queue going at the door, but I had to read that. I had to read that article.
Oh, thank you.
So we'll be talking all about Isle of Dogs, and we will be also having an interview, which we've definitely recorded, not happening after this. Sam, tell us about it.
It was with the animation director, Mark Waring, and he said some incendiary things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shocking, terrifying, horrifying. You'll hear it when we play it.
And that really translates into the film.
Those, like, poor
it's
dogs.
It's very much a horror film.
Yeah.
Poor dogs.
What they put those through is... Yep. Yeah.
All right. So this Isle of Dogs, if you haven't heard of it, is set in Japan. It follows a young boy named Atari and the odyssey he goes on in search of his lost dog, Spots. And I think really the human story is kind of the subplot, really. For me, anyway, it's just seeing these dogs, because there's a big ragtag group on this trash island led by Bryan Cranston, who is chief. And we just meet his little gang and we stroll around this island. And really, that's what, for me, this film is all about.
I think, if anything, though, the dogs are more human than the humans, one might say. I mean, there's a lot of sensitive lads in this amongst that posse of pups, which I think actually, yeah, you kind of relate. And I think maybe, and obviously this will be something we talk about a little bit more, but perhaps one of the film's flaws is that you kind of detach slightly more from the humans over the sake of relating more to the dogs.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think a lot of people are saying that they would rather just follow the dog story.
Yeah, because you're just hanging out with the dogs. Yeah. It's not like you're actively... They do have a plot, but you're happy just to be and just hang out with them and listen to their relationships with each other and their kind of, I don't want to say that word, but I will say it, banter between each other.
It's kind of, I think one of my favourite scenes is they're just walking through kind of a long grassed field, talking about reminiscing about their favourite meals. One is, oh, salt and pepper steak, but I only have that on my birthday. And, oh, I love ice cream. My owner, he had a sweet tooth and he passed that on to me. And it's just that those kind of ramblings that you're hanging off there every word. And I think that's a real real craft where Wes Anderson's concerned.
Well, and I think we look at the pun in the title of the film. He's very much just, I think what came first is maybe, I want to make a dog film. And then you figure out what the story and the plot is that you wrap around those dogs after.
An anti-cat film as well.
Yeah. Yeah, this is very anti-cat.
This, yeah.
They get a rough ride.
Big problem with that.
But I want to start with you, Beth, to go actually look at some of the ideas that you put forward in the article that you've written for the Curzon magazine, which is this idea of animation in Wes Anderson's work before his actual animated films. Because as a master of construction, it makes sense that for a man who's so particular and so precise and has built a name about that, that he would want to go into this world.
Exactly. I think it was 2009, Fantastic Mr. Fox, which was the first fully stop motion film that he made. But before that, you obviously see it spring up in things like The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, with that beautiful kind of leopard-spotted jaguar shark, which, if memory serves, was one of the biggest models used in film ever. Just kind of taking that distinct, very kind of, I'm thinking of the word now, auteurism. He applies that kind of auteur flair to animation, so it kind of transcends the different mediums, which is very impressive. Return to stop motion for him, but you know, if anything, that kind of lends itself to his, that really kind of crack dry wit that he applies to his characters and to his scenarios.
Yeah, and this is different to Fantastic Mr. Fox, where I think Fantastic Mr. Fox is really just animal characters that behave like humans, like, and talk like humans,
and wear clothes.
Yeah, and they're very. It's a like huge. Like this is a. It's a heist film that's wrapped in a
Roald Dahl fairy tale.
Exactly, and this isn't very. This is very different to that in that there is a difference between the people, the dogs, and there's a distinct drawing of the line between the two, which doesn't quite happen in Fantastic Mr. Fox. I think he's more interested in building a world with this one.
Yeah, and I think as well, even in the live-action Wes Anderson films, that everything's so constructed by him that it's almost... Because with animation, you have more control. You have control over everything with animation. And you get the sense that he has that even in live-action. Every background, every bit of lighting, or the camera's so, like, you know, this whole... Think like the symmetrical shot in a Wes Anderson film. He's so in control of everything that it's not a huge leap for him to go into animation.
Yeah, so it's like a meticulous detail, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which he applies to himself. And I know that a lot of people say, God, he could just step straight into his film and just slot in there.
Also looks like a murderer. This is becoming... So I pointed this out on Twitter and now people have been sharing more pictures as well of him in different outfits. One was that... Wes Anderson is the kind of character that would be a supporting character in Hannibal that would eventually get eaten by the end of the series. now I can't not look at him as a kind of serial killer rather than a character in his own film. But, you know.
I liked your tweet where you said he's the kind of person that would kill people and kind of trap their souls in those tiny miniature. I'd love to just walk around in your mind sometimes, Jake. I think it's a very dark place.
Wes Anderson, this like lovely, sweet man who's made
very nice, colourful films, and you're like, serial killer.
Absolutely, mercenary.
he's very secretive though, isn't he? Like, he doesn't do many interviews.
Yeah.
That's why he doesn't want people to know.
Yeah, exactly. We went to the exhibition of the sets, and you can just hear screaming from inside. These little, like,
I assumed as much. Help!
It was awful.
Yeah.
It was really. I've not quite come back from there.
Yeah, there was like a tiny Bryan Cranston just walking around.
I haven't seen him for a while, actually. Yeah,
that's what he's up to. Let's talk about the exhibition, because I think, like, whilst people are listening to this, there's still an opportunity to go on to it. Sam, you haven't had the chance.
I haven't yet. Convince me.
It's wonderful, isn't it? It's like, even though we would encourage you to watch this at the cinema and watch it as big as possible, you're still never going to get the amount of detail that is actually on show in these sets.
Exactly. And I'd been before seeing the film, so I saw the film after going to the exhibition. And I don't think it spoils it. I think if you want to look into it and look for clues and look for kind of, could this mean this? Don't do that. Just go and enjoy the splendour. Enjoy, like we say, this kind of meticulous attention to detail. A friend went at the weekend and had a little look around the back. So everyone was kind of marvelling at the splendour sort of face on, and he was looking at the masking tape and things, kind of sticking it together. And it's just a nice way to spend like an afternoon, really.
Yeah, it's really, really lovely. And I'm sure we get into this with Mark Waring, just about how many... Actually, I think there's quite a small team I think it's about 33 okay. people that are involved in this, which is amazing. When
I'm sure we'll find out in the interview.
Yeah. But like, how much time would it spent on it? And I'd be interested to learn about what role Wes Anderson actually has in that, like whether he just drops in and just checks that everyone's doing the right thing.
Well, that's it. And it was filmed in London, wasn't it? Mm. I was actually at a public screening of Isle of Dogs, and there were a few people kind of craning to look at the credits and a few cheers. I feel like actually it's a good place to watch it, is in London, because it was all kind of, well, created here, which is pretty unheard of, I think, unless, you know, Aardman in Bristol, but you don't get a lot of UK animation, which is...
Well, and it was recorded here as well. The cast actually came over to England to record their lines, except one.
Who?
Mr. Jeff Goldblum.
Oh, really?
Oh,
yeah.
Goodness.
But he loves London.
I know, he loves foggy London town.
That was stunning. That was just wonderful.
he had a job on. So he just recorded them over the phone. Like, not even...
Oh, great. Sorry. Yeah. Do you know what else is in London?
What?
The Isle of Dogs.
Oh, man. That's good.
Yeah.
That's really good. Good. All right. I didn't realize this is where this film was set.
Yeah.
It's deceptive because the sets were
confusing,
you think it's
isn't
Japan.
It?
You would
really
think
confusing.
It's in Japan.
But it's in
but
London.
No, apparently London.
Yeah.
Who'd have thunk?
It's on the map. Isle of Dogs.
All right. Should we maybe talk about what the film, what happens in the film?
Nah.
Or should, actually, should we go to the interview and then we'll get
Let's do the interview, yeah. Mark Waring was the animation director of the film, and he has worked previously. He worked on Fantastic Mr. Fox. He has worked with Tim Burton on Corpse Bride and Frankenweenie. So he's a man who knows his stuff about stop motion animation. And we, I'm sure, had a lovely chat. Okay, and we're now joined by Mark Waring, the animation director of Isle of Dogs. Thank you very much for joining us.
No problem, nice to be here.
So do you want to start by telling us what it is exactly that you do and what your role was on Isle of Dogs?
I'm an animation director, and as part of my job as on the Isle of Dogs, basically it was just to organise and run the animation department. Yeah. So I was heading up that team. So part of the initial job was to speak with Wes, understand what he was wanting from like the script, from the initial ideas. So sort of brought in at a fairly early stage. So it was sort of getting a grip of what the production was, what we needed, and then bringing in like an animation team. So like putting the team together, the animators, the assistants, gradually building that up over a period of time, and actually trying to sort of tailor and mentor those animators to try and sort of get Wes's vision, I suppose, onto the screen.
And I heard that this is 8 years in the running, this film?
Quite possibly. I mean, it's been a few years since Fantastic Mr. Fox came out. So whether this was brewing around that sort of time, I mean, I sort of led to believe that he used to come to the studio and in the cab or whatever on the way over, he used to see the signs for a direction to the Isle of Dogs and thought, oh, that's a nice idea. Yeah. I might sort of expand on that. So I don't know whether that's an urban myth or whether that's sort of fits quite nicely.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Sort of going to the East End and that's where we shoot there. Yeah. So it sort of ties in quite nicely. And
brilliant.
Sort of with a new idea and sort of putting that all together.
Yeah. And what sort of stage would you normally come onto a project like this? Like, were you there when the script was being made, or was it a bit later? Or?
It was quite early on, actually. I mean, the script had been written.
Okay.
So I was contacted and had an early sort of, like I say, little sort of chat with Wes about the production. But at that point, they'd been working on an animatic, which is like a sort of a storyboarded out version of that. So it hadn't been completed, but they were working on that. So they had an idea of the actual structure, I guess, and sort of how it was going to look. But it was more the look and the style of it that was sort of still sort of in that process. So I was on board at that point to try and work out, you know, the look of it, the style, how the animation was going to sort of appear on the screen.
Yeah.
Is it smooth? Is it rough? Is there any references for that? You know, where, all those sort of elements. So it was quite an early stage. It was quite nice then to develop that into testing when we actually had puppets and working with that. So it was the development time was sort of crucial in a way in actually sort of staging the whole film, but I was sort of at the beginning of that process.
Yeah. And so you were on Fantastic Mr. Fox with Wes.
I was, yeah.
Because that was his first animation film, obviously. Was he very much like a newcomer to that when he came onto that film and had to sort of relearn this new skill in a way?
I think it was. I mean, it's it was slightly different. I've worked on Tim Burton films before, and he sort of has a history of animation. In you know, he was an animator. I think he, you know, that's how he started in his career. So, but I think Wes hadn't had that, but he obviously had he was a fan of that sort of style of animation. I think he enjoys those sort of the classic, I don't know, through his childhood, I think, growing up, like Rankin Bass and those sort of like holiday sort of entertainment things that had a stop frame feel to them. I think he quite enjoyed those, and sort of, I think it's mainly about the craft of it. I think his films are all about craft.
Yeah, absolutely.
The actual sort of the detail, you know, they're absolutely full of that sort of work. And with stop frame, you get all that for free. I mean, it's, you know, because you have to make all the objects, so they're actually physical things. So you have to develop that, the make the things, design them, paint them, all that sort of stuff, which is exactly what he's into. So I think that was obviously of an interest to him to try and go that route. And I think as he started into that process, he realised that he had ultimate control over everything.
Yeah,
there was no being forced, like if you're shooting a live action thing, the light's going so you can't shoot or you can't do something. He could control things. He could make sure that everything was absolutely spot on before he actually let it out. So I think he learnt that process as well, especially the boarding side of it was interesting, because I think the process of actually being able to literally board out every single shot, and that's what you got. There wasn't no compromise in that. You know, live action, you can't get that because of whatever reason. If you're doing a stop frame film, you build a set, you point the camera at it, and you can get it absolutely exactly where you want it to be. And again, I think that fits in with his ethos and how he likes to present his work. And I think it's that sort of thing that he's almost like led back into his live action films, the actual boarding process. Because I think Grand Budapest Hotel, I think he completely boarded that film out as almost like an animation film.
Right,
okay. So he had a working animatic, and they just followed that. That's, in a way, what gives it its fullness and its richness in that, because it's so worked out ahead of time. So I think he's sort of it's fluid between those two mediums now, and it's sort of like, it's almost like it's just a filmmaking process that he uses. So.
It's the idea that he can completely build a world from scratch.
Exactly, I think that's absolutely right, and I think that's obviously what you can do. And you know, with Isle of Dogs, he's built a world from scratch, but it's unusual in stop frame because you physically have to build this world.
Yeah.
You know, it's something where, we've got amazing amount of sets and locations and characters, hundreds of characters, you know, there's hundreds of sets. So it was a very, very ambitious project to do that, but Wes didn't want to compromise that. He had this idea of this Isle of Dogs world in his head, and he just wanted to realize that. And part of our process was to actually sort of achieve that, I suppose.
So what was Wes's kind of brief to the animation department like? Because it's not, it's not like it's perfectly fluid. You know, there's some rough edges to it.
No, absolutely. Yeah. And that was deliberate. That was absolutely designed to be that way. Yeah. I mean, we had the discussions at the start. I mean, you can take it in all sorts of directions. I mean, there's, stop frame, it's an open board. I mean, you can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
I mean, you can go to Leica do amazing work, but their work is very slick.
Yeah.
You know, like Box Trolls or Coraline or whatever, they you know, those sort of films, they're very, very crafted films, but their design and their look is very smooth, it's very slick. We deliberately didn't go that route. He wanted to see the craft, see the handmade, actually see the mistakes. And also, sometimes when we did stuff that was a little bit too smooth, he broke it up, he took frames out, edited stuff out to actually give it a little bit more, I don't know, weight, a little bit more sort of substance to it. So it was a deliberate choice. Also, like with faces, we have, to give different expressions, we have replacement faces on the human characters.
Yeah.
Again, going back to Leica, they have a process of printing these out and they can develop them on computers. And it gives a beautiful, fluid approach to how you can change an expression or speak or that sort of thing. And it's an amazing process. And I mean, there's thousands and thousands and thousands of these replacement heads that you put on the character for each frame. Wes wanted to do that route, but he just didn't want to do it like that. So we had a very, very limited palette.
Yeah.
You know, a face would pop from one to another. Literally, it would just one frame pop But he wanted to see the pop. He wanted people to know that that was a pop. And he wanted to sort of see, almost like they were like masks, you know, there's a kabuki theatre sort of sequence in there. But it was something like that he wanted to get. It was, again, like going back to Leica, they do the development on a computer to get, you know, a sort of a very fluid style. And Wes, in order to not do that, he had them hand sculpted. Right. So they were all done individually by hand. So there is... Naturally, if you pop from one to another, there's going to be a discrepancy. It's inherent. It's built in, and they're hand painted as well. So again, there's another level to that. So all these things were designed to give a sort of it's not a roughness, but it's a viewable, natural, textural feel that he was deliberately wanted to see there. He wasn't trying to hide that in any way. It was a deliberate approach. So it's quite a brave approach because the pure animation sort of fraternity may look at that and go, oh, it's not as good as I think it could be. Yeah. But that wasn't the intention. Sure. The intention wasn't about that. It was about telling the story and the idea that these dogs, you know, they're on an island, they're rough and ready, they've been abandoned, they're sort of feeling awful, they look terrible. You know, all those things sort of fitted in with that idea that it's all a bit sort of rough and ready and it's, you know, it's earthy almost.
Yeah, this goes back to the... sort of argument idea that you can see the thumbprints on the plasticine.
No, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, again, I think there was, again, maybe it's an urban myth, I'm not sure, but Aardman did it so well.
Yeah.
They got the technique of plasticine down so well. It was super smooth and it was almost looking like a sort of CG process.
Right.
And they sort of realised that it was all too good. So they actually ended up sort of messing stuff up and actually putting stuff back in.
That's
well, they didn't need to. So it's sort of that process, and I think it's the right medium for it. I mean, if you do go too far the other way, then it does become something else. It becomes something that's competing with CG, and it shouldn't be that. It should be it's a handmade process. It's something that you know you have to make the costumes, you have to make the puppets, you have to make the sets. They're physically there in space. You know, there's something about it that's tangible. It's that's the important part of it. And if you embrace that and go with that. That's what it is. That's the world. That's the world Wes has built. Who's to argue that it isn't supposed to be that way?
Sure.
So it's all valid. It's not a fault or a something that's wrong. It's actually a conscious choice.
Yeah, I think there's a kind of this kind of existing conception that stop motion animation is really painstaking and really long. And like, is that the case still? Is it that long? That much of a sort of fiddly
process. Is a long process. I mean, just by the nature of how you actually physically have to do it. But we're going as fast as we can. it's not like we're going slowly. I mean, we as an animation team are going as quickly as humanly possible to get this thing done in the time. So it's a perception of how long things are.
Right,
I mean, if you ask an animator, they're rushing.
Sure.
they're working really hard day after day after day as fast as they possibly can to get this done. And it just so happens that their work is a slow process. So, you know, on a good day, an animator, depends on obviously what shot they're doing, but on an average, we're trying to aim for about two seconds per animator per day on screen. Which is... not a lot of time, you know, in our scheme of things. But in order to do that, there's a whole load of other processes that have to happen around the animator.
Yeah.
I mean, even before you start, you know, sets have got to be made, built, positioned. The lighting team's got to come in, light stuff. Then as an animation side of it, you know, you might come in and do some tests, then do maybe a little sort of pop through if there's a complicated shot where there's lots of characters. You've got to work out the choreography of that, where a camera might move to, is it okay with the lighting? So you go through that process. If you've got time and it's sort of available, then you might do like a sort of rough rehearsal of that. So there's a whole rehearsal process. Only then do you actually do the shot.
Right.
And at that point, you hopefully have got all the information you need to actually go forward and shoot, and you get your 2 seconds a day. So from start to finish, it is a long process, but it's not a case that people are sitting around and it's just, you know, the time is just ticking by. Everybody's working really hard. There's a big team of people that are actually trying to do this. So, but in order to sort of facilitate that, obviously we have quite a few animators that work at the same time. I know we've got up to about 30-ish altogether at our peak point. that's including assistants. So there's a lot of people working together on stages, and we had up to about 50-ish units to shoot in.
Wow.
So there's 50 stages that we're working on at any one time. You know, some are being built, some are being shot on, some are being dismantled. So there's a whole fluid process, but it's ongoing all the time. It's like all these things add up. Mm. So if an animator's doing a couple of seconds a day, then again, in a good week, we might hit about 2 minutes-ish.
Okay. Yeah.
2 minutes of footage to get into the film per week. So if you're looking at that, it's sort of relative. You can sort of work out how long the production's going to be. But it's sort of relative. I mean, a CG production, you know, if it's a computer-generated film, that's equally as slow. You've still got an animator.
Yeah.
You know, they've still got to animate. You've still got to go through a whole process of approvals, designs, the animation process, any rendering that has to happen, any lighting that still has to happen on that. So there's still a huge amount of time that those films take. It's not like stop frame is extortionately longer than any other medium. You know, it's a slow process to make an animated feature film.
And when these, you know, 50 stages are being, you know, worked on at once, is Wes kind of floating around all of them, or is he focused on one per day? Or
no, I mean, he's... To be honest, he's rarely there on a daily basis. I mean, that's part of my job, my remit, is I'm sort of his eyes and ears on the floor.
Right, okay.
So having said that, he's, by not actually physically being there, he is there at all times covering everything. He works mainly by email. So we send absolutely everything to him on a daily basis. And it's all about communication. So we're backwards and forwards with ideas, images, setups, designs, everything goes to him. I mean, personally, I had about 50,000 emails on the production. Jeez. And that's just my side. I mean, you've got all the other departments that are emailing, he's emailing back.
Yeah.
So he's, strangely, if he was there, and when we did have him there in the studio, because he's so focused on what he does, he tends to work very sort of strongly on one particular area. So it might be we're looking at one set or a couple of sets, maybe we get through three things during the day. Work very, you know, it's great to have that sort of direct input because you can move things forward very quickly. But he'll only see those three things, whereas working slightly remotely from that, he can actually oversee 40 things all at the same time and get back to them really, really quickly.
Right.
Whereas it's very difficult, as I mean, again, part of my job is to sort of go around and try and see everybody during the day. And I'm just being raced around the studio constantly, seeing one person, I have a couple of minutes with them, and it's like, you've got to go and see the next person, you go and see that. And it's really difficult to keep that moving and constantly flowing, because you've got to just try and keep everything moving forward all the time. So by doing what I'm doing, it sort of frees him up to allow more attention to a different department or a different part of the production he's actually working on at that particular time. So it sort of works that way. It's a quite collaborative sort of way to work.
There's a couple of sequences that really stand out to me as they must have, you know, taken a lot of planning to do. And those are, so there's like the dog fights in the film where they all have the scuffle and there's all the smoke that comes out around them. And then there's the sushi scene. Were those particularly troublesome sequences?
Say troublesome. I mean, everything in the film was an issue and a problem.
Yeah, right.
It's like reading the script. Every single thing was, how do we do that?
Yeah.
How do we make those dogs? How do we do some water? How do we do the smoke? How do we do the steam? All those things. We had to go through a whole process of development on those. Quite a lot of the elements. You know, the sort of smoke, airs, waters, that sort of thing. It's almost as much work as actually the animation of the characters,
because
you have to work into that. For the fight, we called it the fight cloud, when the animals are fighting in there. I mean, it was a very early reference that Wes sort of picked up on, that sort of slightly cartoony sort of Roadrunner, Tex Avery style, where the characters clash and there's a big sort of fight. I mean, we could have actually had it with the characters fighting, but it would have been technically a huge difficult process. So actually it's slightly a way of disguising a lot of potential work, but it sort of brings another level to it that's slightly unusual and just an intriguing way of solving a problem in a physical form. Yeah. So we had to work out, you know, we had to have like cotton and wadding. We had different sort of techniques for doing that. And then we had to realize, okay, well, it's going to be quite big. So we had to build like a structure inside it, almost like a metal skeleton armature inside the fight cloud to support the yeah. actual material. And also it was quite useful because we've had arms and legs of characters sticking out yeah. so they could be attached to this. So it was almost this mutant metal mass underneath the cloud. But that was a process. We got to that point by developing the idea yeah. and what we needed to do. But it was always the end goal to have something that looked a bit sort of, you know, sort of drawn cartoon style yeah. in that. And again, going into the sushi, that was a brief that we had at a very early stage that Wes wanted to have a sort of cultural references through the yeah. film that were correct. You know, there's sure. you know, Kabuki theatre, there's taiko drummers, there's the sumo wrestling, yeah. you know, all these places, all these things. We had to research quite a lot into all the cultural aspects to make sure they were right. We were doing it, you know, in a sympathetic way yeah. that was understood. You know, people would watch it and go, oh yeah, that's how they do that. That's the right etiquette or whatever. So it was all very carefully thought about. But the sushi was something that Wes wanted. I think it was a favorite sushi chef of his that
okay.
I think it's from in Paris that he, when he visits there, he uses a lot. So it's sort of based on this one guy, and we sculpted his hands to look like him.
Wow.
And, but he wanted to get a yeah. sense of the sushi being recognizable. So if you're a sushi chef, you could go, okay, they're holding the knife in the right way, they're cutting in the right yeah. way. The process is obviously stylized, but he wanted to make sure that it was sort of correct in that way, but also we would develop out of that a style of sushi that had never, ever been done before in the whole history yeah. of sushi making. And it would be the greatest sushi thing ever. So it was quite a tough brief.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we had to go through that. And again, it was a process. We had to develop what we were going to do, what items we were going to use, yeah. how to research the actual cutting processes and the how they are held things in hands and, yeah. and all those sort of that sort of side of it. Then obviously the armatures have to be made. You can't just cut a stop frame fish in half. You're going to have yeah. to work out, can it wriggle? How does it wriggle? You know, how do we make it move? We've got to put something inside it, or we can't cut it then. So we're going to have replacement bits. Okay, right. We've got to make those replacement bits. What do they look like? So there's a whole sort of development process, even before we got anywhere near shooting. And then yeah. we did lots of testing. We did like a very rough pass of everything made out of cardboard and bits and yeah. bobs to actually sort of develop, is this looking right? Because we didn't want to get halfway through it and realize, oh, this isn't working. So all in all, it was probably about 6 months of work.
Okay, wow.
For that one yeah. shot in the film, which is mad.
Yeah.
But there was no way around it. There was no shortcut sure. in that. We had to go through those processes to get to build to where we were at the end.
And finally, Mark, so you've worked with these big directors, Tim Burton, Wes Anderson, and they're like real beloved directors. And they're making these prestige animated films. Have you noticed a change in like recent years about the reception of animated films from like the sort of critic community?
Yeah, I think so. I think they were sort of always seen as slightly niche things, especially features. I mean,
yeah.
But I think everybody loves a good story.
Yeah.
And if it works as a story, you know, people are going to enjoy that. So I think there's been a huge resurgence. I mean, not just stop frame, but in all sorts of mediums. You know, you've got Pixar, you know, winning awards, winning Oscars, up for, yeah. you know, almost going for the actual live action yeah. awards, which is incredible. You know, that's a huge tick in animation's box.
Yeah.
But I think, I mean, not that it is about money, but I think a lot of features have never really been successful hugely in the box office, critically, yes, but in the box office. But I think now distributors and finances are realising, oh, actually, they do make money. There's, yeah. there's a longevity to it. There's a, you know, people will go and see a good film. If it's well made, well crafted, people will enjoy that.
Yeah.
But also there is a back end to that. I mean, the merchandising side of it and all that sort of stuff. And I think that's always it's always been there, but I think now, you know, there's more emphasis on that. And I think it becomes as part of the whole package. I mean, it shouldn't be just about that. It should be about the film itself, and that's what we do. I mean, we craft these films because we love making them. But if they are successful, then there will be more of them. Yeah. So we want them to be successful. Yeah, yeah. So it's like a double-edged sword there. It's a little bit of a catch-22. But all you can do is make a good film. That's what you try and do. So you hopefully, you know, by doing that and putting your best into it, then the results will come out the other side. But I think it's... There has been a change, and I think there is. I think there's more awareness of, you know, I think, you know, kids now are more aware that, you know, animated films are available. They can they're out there. They can go and see them in the cinema. It's not something you get just on a DVD or whatever. Yeah. There's a big screen feel about that, and I think that's where stop frame fits in as well, because it's a great experience. You know, you go and see these films on the screen.
Yeah.
And they're huge. They're you know, visually, they're
cinematic,
toys, cinematic. Yeah. These things that they maybe sort of play with at home or whatever come to life, and it's an amazing thing to see. So, you know, rather than just seeing it on their phones or whatever, I think that's a great thing. And I think there's a sort of a feeling that sort of involving adults as well into that process of animated films. So it's not just for kids. You can make it work on different levels. You know, you can bring in adult themes or sort of an understanding of a storyline that maybe is something that's going to engage adults as well. So it's not just one demographic or one market that you're actually aiming these sort of animated films at. They're a broader range. And I think that's a slightly a newer feel to these things. And I think that's an interesting thing. You know, how do you balance that? How do you make that work for both, if that's your target? You know, because you get adults and kids to go.
Yeah.
You know, it's great they're all be entertained, but if you're looking on a purely financial basis, you've got a whole family going to the cinema, which is obviously good for everybody on that side of it as well. So it's I think that's it's not the goal of every animation film, but I think that's partly a newish sort of thing to actually sort of try and cater for both of those things. So I think, you know, long may that continue, because I think that will make interesting films and interesting ideas. And you know, especially like Isle of Dogs, it's got quite a few of those.
Yeah.
More, you know, scratch the surface, and there's some deeper themes in there that will, you know, cause people to question and think and come away from the film being entertained, but also actually, you know, that's got a little message there as well. Mm. That's saying something, you know. And I think that's an important thing to have as well. It's like a extra strings to your bow in actually the filmmaking process.
Absolutely. Mark Roy, thank you for your time.
No problem. Nice to talk to you.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So Sam, how was that?
Oh, the best experience of my life.
Yeah. It wasn't too wearing.
I didn't think you'd start throwing things.
Yeah, that was a bit uncomfortable. But I would start catching them and throwing them back. So it was a nice little back and forth between us.
Oh, it was like a little stop motion in itself.
It was indeed, yeah. But stop motion, I've always said, works best on a podcast.
Yeah, definitely. Did he then trap you inside a tiny little body?
He did. So that's why I'm the size I am now.
Yeah. Okay, so Isle of Dogs. This is about Atari Kobayashi, who is a boy who's orphaned and then made to ward his bad uncle, who is also the mayor.
Mayor Kobayashi.
Yes.
Kobayashi is also the name under the cup in Usual Suspects.
Is it really?
It is. And I think like this is something that we can definitely get stuck into this, and we could probably spend a whole podcast on this, of this idea of like Wes Anderson very much being a Western voice, applying that to Japanese culture.
In the, I mean, that, Atari.
Yeah, which is not a Japanese name, which is the name that two men came up with for their video game system to sound Japanese. And Kobayashi, which is most famous for being the cup in Usual Suspects.
And, well, Pete Postlethwaite's character is Mr. Kobayashi.
Yeah.
Or is it? In Usual Suspects.
So he's warding his mayor, and the mayor is very much a cat person. He hates dogs, and there's this conspiracy of snout fever.
Yes.
Yes.
That is infecting all the dogs, and so he sends them all to live on Trash Island. But one of these beloved dogs, Spots, is that of Atari. And
the first dog.
Yeah. Dog Zero.
Yeah.
And Dog Zero, Spots, is sent to Trash Island. And then, is it a month? A few months?
I think it's a few months later.
A few months later, Atari takes a tiny little plane to Trash Island to look for his dog. And that's where we start meeting everyone.
Yeah.
I loved it. I think it's not without its flaws. I mean, what isn't, really? Do a little reading before you go into this, perhaps. Maybe my friend who I watched it with, who said, you know, don't watch it in a bubble. Be aware that perhaps, you know, just things like notice things like you can understand the dog speaking, but there's no subtitles. And it's very much addressed sort of first in the first few scenes that, you know, you will hear the dog speaking in English. You will not hear Japanese. There won't be Japanese subtitles. That's very much left for you to kind of decipher from that what you will, which I think in that is part of the problem, really, because you do just have to sort of guess and go by. I know it was a conscious decision by Anderson, but I ended up sort of just not communicating or not really connecting with those characters as much, but obviously loving the dogs.
Yeah, because the Japanese characters aren't subtitled. They'll have a translator or a radio broadcast.
It's Frances McDormand for most of the film, which is quite surreal. Yeah. She's the translator.
She's the translator, but then occasionally you are just left to kind of fend for yourself. And because of that, and some of the most distraught and frustrating parts of the film, you know, are the parts without the subtitles. And he kind of makes Atari into kind of a caricature at times to compensate for the fact that you can't understand what he's saying. And I thought that was a bit of an issue.
I think it, as well, you were right in saying that he wants you to cite, it's a dog's story. Mm. This is what he wants you to focus on. This is what he wants everyone to talk about. He wants this to be a film about the dogs. And maybe it's problematic, but to really ensure that it's that you don't know what the humans are saying to each other. And I think it's a very sort of simple technique to use, ultimately.
Yeah, compared to Fantastic Mr. Fox, where it's just everyone can talk to each other.
Yeah.
And there's no rules.
Well, you can hear all the American humans. You can hear Greta Gerwig, wonderful Greta Gerwig. Mm. I would have liked to have connected to all characters. Mm.
Yeah, I think that is true.
You
do end up connecting more to the dog story.
Yeah, inevitably so. But I just think that was just something, if you go to that extraordinary amount of effort to make an extraordinary film, maybe make it so you can understand everyone in that film.
Yeah.
Also, you know, I mean, Wes Anderson isn't great at kind of presenting very rounded, kind of formulated female characters. I think that, again, they sort of took the bullet again here. It was kind of that the role that they served was to kind of vamp up the males and give them strength and give them support, but never actually had much of a storyline themselves. But I still loved it. I still absolutely loved it, and it made me laugh. And I can't say much about Tilda Swinton's character other than to say she was my favourite.
She is the Oracle.
Oracle.
She's a tiny pug called Oracle, and I don't really want to say much more than that because she's a real scene stealer of a pup.
Yeah. I think, and every dog has his day, you know, and everyone gets their moment. And maybe we should do a roll call because this cast list is pretty long.
But that's the thing at the end of the trailer, isn't it? It goes through everyone with the drums going.
Yeah.
So we've got Bryan Cranston as Chief and Koyo Rankin as Atari Kobayashi. Those are our big players, really.
Yeah.
But then along with that, Ed Norton as Rex, Bob Balaban as King, Bill Murray as Boss, Jeff Goldblum as Duke, Kenichi Nomura as Mayor Kobayashi, Akira Takeyama as Mayor Major Domo, Greta Gerwig as Tracy Walker, Frances McDormand as Interpreter Nelson, Akira Itu as Professor Watanabe, Scarlett Johansson as Nutmeg, Harvey Keitel as Gondo, F. Murray Abraham as Jupiter. Jupiter's wonderful.
Jupiter's a cool character. Yeah.
Yoko Ono as Assistant Scientist Yoko Ono, Tilda Swinton as Oracle, Ken Watanabe as Head Surgeon, Mari Natsuki as Auntie, Fisher Stevens as Scrap, Nijiro Murakami as Editor Moroshi, Leif Schreiber as Spots, Courtney B. Vance as the narrator, Yujiro Noda as News Anchor, and Frank Wood as Simul Translate Machine. and not forgetting Angelica Houston as Mute Dog. Which is in the credits.
She was brilliant. Yeah, sad to say. She's a scene stealer. Yeah. God.
Yeah.
Only true fans would spot that cameo.
Yeah.
Who was she?
Genuinely, it's just in the credits. She's a mute animal.
For goodness sake.
What did she do? Just stand next to a microphone for 2 hours.
It's the most weird.
Do you think he directed her?
Yeah.
Do you think he paid her?
Well, I hope that it was only, like, Jeff Goldblum did it over the phone from LA, but Angelica Houston came over to England.
Yeah. Stood around.
Right. So there's a massive cast list there. There's lots of old favourites from Wes Anderson films with Edward Norton, Bob Balaban, Bill Murray, Jeff Goldblum, Frances McDormand, like loads of people on there. And it's interesting to me that he brings in a new boy, a good boy.
He's a very good boy.
For the lead. Yeah. Bryan Cranston, what do we reckon as chief?
I mean, you just can't go wrong with Bryan Cranston. I feel like that's almost too easy a choice.
Okay.
But in that he's effortlessly, in that, just stretch that to about seven syllables then. He's effortlessly authoritative and authentic and commanding, and he's just got that, like, depth to his voice that just carries, and you would just follow him wherever he went, really. And he's got this chip on his shoulder, and an easy but effective choice, I think.
The last thing people would have seen him in was Last Flag Flying.
Friend of the show, Bryan Cranston.
Yeah, almost double friend of the show.
Couldn't quite make it.
I will text him next time. And I think there is something in the Last Flag Flying role of that kind of just gruff captain authority figure that, like, even in this film, even though he's a dog, he feels like he's maybe drunk a lot of whiskey in his life.
So, yeah. from the floor.
Yeah, and
I think his character in if his character in Last Flag Flying was in this team of dogs, that he'd be well up for the adventure. Yeah. He'd be, come on, let's go.
Yeah, which is not Chief's role, really.
No, Chief is the naysayer of the pack. Mm. He's the one that doesn't trust the humans.
Mm. We meet all the gang. Well, there's a core gang, which is Chief, Rex, King, Boss, and Duke.
Do you know which one I had a problem with?
Which one?
Knowing me, which one do you think I had a problem with?
Wow, those? I have no idea.
King.
Why's that?
Because he wears human clothes.
Oh, yeah, you're scared of animals in human clothes.
King wasn't the mascot.
No,
isn't King...
No, Bill Murray's Boss isn't...
Boss was my favourite.
Boss with the Dodgers jersey.
Who was the one? Is that Boss?
With the Dodgers, he's the sports mascot.
Mascot. That was Boss. Fight you. Boss was brilliant.
Yeah, it's blurring a line.
A mascot. It was his job. He was just doing his job.
I had a problem with it.
Well, I've got a problem with you, Sam.
Yeah, he's nice. They're nice dogs. They're good nice dogs, Brent.
Great dog, Sam.
So there's this little gang of Rex, King, Boss, Duke, and then Chief is the leader. And they kind of squabble amongst themselves when Atari crash lands on the trash island about what do we do with this kid? Do we help him? And they're up there helping them. But Chief has been burnt by humans before, and he very much is into the fact that they're isolated and they can do what they want and they shouldn't really help anyone anymore.
He's like Cobra in Planet of the Apes.
Yes.
If you remember Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
He's the one that doesn't trust the humans when everyone else does.
Good.
No. Little reference. Callback.
Yeah, do that. Saw that film. Great. And then it's his journey of trust and learning what it is to be a dog.
Feelings.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to, like, the shortlist article, you know, the shortlist think piece, like, this crying dog made me get over my hypermasculinity and embrace the inner hound. I don't know. There's bound to be, like, a think piece in there. You can have that shortlist. You can have that on me. But it's incredible.
It's okay to be a mutt.
But yeah, I there's a lot of character development over plot, really. Plot is kind of, as you say, the plot is just kind of a sub part to this animation. And there's a lot of confrontation and, you know, they break down and they pledge oaths of allegiance and it's all very regal and loyal and, yeah, like dogs.
Yeah, and that's... So on Trash Island, that plot is really just we're wandering Trash Island and we're getting to know each other and we're becoming friends. F-R-I-E-N-D-S. Do you really need them?
Yes.
So, yeah, and that's a really lovely journey to go on. And as we said, that's the one that we're probably most happy to stay in. But maybe this is a good opportunity to talk about what's going on outside of the island.
Yeah, I think this is, for me, the weakest part of the film would be what's going on outside of the island. Mm-hmm. Because what's happening on the island is so good and so fun. And you just really enjoy being with this pack that when it goes back and it's very plotty.
Mm-hmm. So when they come onto the island, so there's a conspiracy that the mayor kind of was the cause of the snout fever or the snout flu or the snout issues, there's a murder of the opposition, and so it all basically comes down, it all falls on the shoulders of Atari and Chief to take down the government and just show that there is a solution, and they have to go and basically try and win over the town.
Yeah, and their person on the inside is exchange student Tracy Walker, who is played by Greta Gerwig.
Yeah.
In a very Wes Anderson move, she's writing for the student paper, and in Wes Anderson world, the student paper can take down.
Oh yeah,
yeah. I remember writing for Inquire in Canterbury.
We did write for Inquire, and we took some people down, didn't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, we did.
Yeah,
we definitely took down the government. That's how much power.
We were like the Washington Post.
Yeah, we were. The Post is actually about us.
Spotlight is about you. Yeah.
So Tracy Walker, she's our lead on the outside world. Really.
I feel like the Tracy Walker character is the character that you're not going to like if you don't like Wes Anderson.
I think you're completely right.
She's the one who I think is super Wes Anderson. Mm. With the way she looks, the way she acts, everything she does, she's from Rushmore. She's one of the Tenenbaums.
Well, she's just like super hyper enthusiastic
and sort of slaps about Yoko Ono at one stage, which I had a bit of an issue with. I think Yoko Ono she says about four or five words in the entire in the entire film, but there's a moment where kind of it's up to her to kind of speak forward and speak the truth, and is understandably quite upset and had a bit of a rocky ride of it, and Tracy really does bash her about a bit, and that felt a little bit, I don't know, I sort of sided with Yoko on that one.
Chocolate milk.
Well,
yeah. I kind of wish Yoko had fought back.
She's drunk on chocolate milk. That's why.
Well, Beth, I think off the point you were just making about her thrashing around Yoko Ono's character brings into the idea of violence in these Wes Anderson films, which is, I think, since Fantastic Mr. Fox, is something he's really leaned into in quite a strange way. I'm thinking of the arrow and the dog in Moonrise Kingdom.
Well, if you think about Royal Tenenbaums, there's a decent amount of knifing in that film, which is
a suicide,
hyper normalized. Yeah.
And the fingers in Grand Budapest.
Well, the whole of Grand Budapest is pretty violent.
Grand Budapest, he really doesn't like cats.
Yeah,
and there's the punching scene where they all punch each other. Yeah, there's always kind of slapstick violence, though, isn't it?
Yeah, and in this, I think he still does that Fantastic Mr. Fox thing of when there is a fight, it's more of a dust cloud.
Which is really fun.
Yeah,
I like that. And just throw cotton wool.
The inventiveness behind the visuals, I will just step and say, is quite brilliant.
Yeah.
Even things like kind of frosting coming out of glasses in the science labs and things. Yeah. It's kind of like snowflakes, like felt snowflakes, and it is just glorious.
It really is. And what was that point was kind of leading me into is what initially I found quite jarring about it, because I'd never really seen it before, but it made me love the film, is that the dogs are all battered and bruised and they've been mistreated or they've hurt themselves, and because there's no one around to help them, they're all a bit jagged and a bit dirty and a scar.
Oh, yeah.
And I initially, because how often do you ever see that in a film? You don't. And then initially I thought, wow, that's quite hard. It's quite hard to look at because I love dogs. And like,
it just
instantly makes me sad to see them hurt. And like, then that made me actually kind of feel for them more because I hadn't seen that before.
I think you're more upset by that than the boy with a piece of plane in his head, lodged in his head. That you can go over, but there's a slightly chewy dog.
Yeah, they're dogs.
So, yeah. Some of them are pretty gammy as well, like yeah. Jupiter and the Harvey Keitel dog. He's
Gondo.
Gondo, he's been through some stuff.
Another scene stealer. Just these, I think it was the sub-characters that made it for me. So it was Oracle. It was, you know, it was Jupiter and it was, the Harvey Keitel. I can't remember the name of Harvey.
Gondo.
Mm. It's just, I think, yeah, he's just got a seamer who speaks, but my goodness, he steals it.
And spots himself, Liev Schreiber, which is really nice. Like a perfect little voice.
A nice voice twin to Bryan Cranston.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Really nice pairing for those two. Gruff, but friendly gruff. Like they'd be a good PE teacher.
Good PE teacher or a cop you'd trust in a dirty town.
Yeah, but he'd be willing to do the stuff that the others won't, but ultimately he's always on the side of justice.
Yeah,
yeah, almost like Jack Reacher.
Almost like Jack Reacher.
Oh, Liev Schreiber could be Jack Reacher.
I was going to say Bryan Cranston. Younger Bryan Cranston. Jack Reacher.
Yeah, could be.
Are they tall enough, though? Can they reach things?
They can't reach.
That's what he does.
That's the whole plot of those films and books. All right. Let's talk about the music.
So it's the West Coast Pop Art Experimental Band, which could be the name of a Wes Anderson film.
Yes.
And they have... So that song is in the trailer. It's also when they're just walking along the horizon. And that's a really nice musical moment that stood out to me.
That's like the big track that's very him. But I think the score is a bit different. It's not...
Alexandre Desplat.
Yeah, but he's not doing the Grand Budapest... thing where it's
sorry, what was it?
It was
I think that it's a bit more chilled at points. There's some whistling in here. There's the sleigh bell ride, the one that turns into the whistle, which is becomes the intro for Greg Lake's I Believe in Father Christmas.
Is it actually from that?
Or it's not from that. No, but it's quite famous. Okay. Famous melody that then gets used for that.
Am I right in saying it uses music from Seven Samurai at one moment?
I don't know.
I believe it might, because there's the scene where the pack are standing off against the robot dogs fairly early on in the film, and almost shot for shot, that scene is from Seven Samurai.
Right.
And I think then it uses a little bit of the music.
Well, he's kind of cited the influences of Kurosawa
all
and
over
stop motion
film. Yeah.
Christmas TV special.
There's a lot of Seven Samurai. There's a lot of... there's a film called Stray Dog by Kurosawa, which is used a lot in this film. There's a lot of Ran in the colour. A little bit of Throne of Blood as well in some of like the mist and things like that. But maybe this goes back to what you were saying earlier. This is kind of like a Western view of Japan.
Mm.
And one of the big insights into Japan in Western culture is Kurosawa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe that's part of that as well.
Well, I think sort of entry it's point. Totally his romanticised view of what an kind of ultimate future Japan would be.
Yeah. Is it Megasaki?
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like 20 years in a future. So like a mild dystopia, I think.
So we're probably going to have to wrap up the Isle of Dogs chat there. But if you've got any thoughts on Isle of Dogs, then do email them to podcast@curzon.com or tweet them and we'll read them out for next week's show. And actually, let's have some thoughts on Unsane, but I don't think either of you guys have actually had the chance to see it yet.
It's Unseen for me.
Oh, right.
That wasn't even words. That was...
that's the end of banter, isn't it? I've done it. I've finished it. It's over, everyone.
Yeah. Santosh Sadol would say it's not over, in fact.
Oh, right.
Okay. He'd say that Unsane is well shot, well acted, and well directed. It goes beyond its shot on iPhone concept to tell a better story than other films of its genre. It's far from being perfect, and despite some flaws, it is an efficient experimental exercise from Soderbergh. 7 hammer blows out of 10.
7 hammer blows out of 10. How many hammer blows are we giving Isle of Dogs?
I don't know whether it would hammer... because they don't have opposable thumbs, so they couldn't hold a hammer.
Okay.
So
how many growls? How many biscuitos?
Puppy treats.
How many puppy treats? I'm going to give this 8 puppy treats.
8
out of 10.
I'm between 7 and 8. I think
I'm exactly the same.
As we learn in the film, you can break the puppy treats in half.
Okay.
So you can have half each.
Thank you. So thanks. 7.5.
Yeah,
puppy treats.
I too will go 7.5.
There we are. All right. And it's not the only film out this week. Sam very quickly, you saw Journeyman, which I think...
I did see Journeyman. Yeah. It's a very good Paddy Considine-directed drama. His first film as a director since Tyrannosaur, which is incredible. It's not quite Tyrannosaur levels. So this is sold as a boxing film, but it's definitely not a boxing film. I'd say there's about 5 minutes of boxing in the whole film. It's about a boxer who suffers a brain injury after a boxing match, and it's then about how he, played by Paddy Considine, and his wife, played by Jodie Whittaker, try and get through the next few months of their life now that he has this new illness. And it goes further than I thought it would with the illness. It's not just a simple, oh, I can't box anymore. Mm. It's actually far more, it's bigger than that.
Right.
And some scenes are quite tough. There's a scene on the phone that a lot of people are talking about, which is incredibly hard to watch, and I welled up. Mm. Yeah, it's really good. It's really nice to see Paddy Considine do things that he clearly loves. I know he loves boxing. He used to be a, he used to photograph boxing matches, I think.
Cool.
It's interesting that he's taken this route to make a boxing film, like, and not make a boxing film. But yeah, I love Paddy Considine, and I'm very glad to see him behind the camera again.
Yeah. And also, I don't know who's designed it, but really gorgeous poster.
It's at the tree.
Yeah, yeah, the tree that becomes his brain inside a silhouette of the head. Just super simple, but really lovely.
And that happens in the film as well. That's the illness. He turns into a tree.
Okay.
No, actually, I had another joke about the film. He's walking, he's on a journey, and then gets struck by lightning. And then becomes Journeyman. So.
Okay, good. All right. If you do want to stay at home this weekend instead of going to the cinema, you can check out Film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool, which is now on Curzon Home Cinema, which is actually a really sweet, lovely film.
Yeah. We were 5 minutes late for that film.
We were.
But it wasn't late on delivering feelings.
They were right on time.
Yeah. And I had a lovely chat with Paul McGuigan, the director of the film, and the director of my new favourite film, Victor Frankenstein, which I hadn't discovered at the time, but if I had, I would go back and talk to him for hours about it.
What was the ETA on feelings in Victor Frankenstein?
From 10 seconds in, because that's when the feelings come.
Good.
And they don't stop coming.
Very prompt.
Yep. So do check that out. And I think that must be the end of the show. So do subscribe if you haven't before. Leave a review and comment on iTunes as well. You can subscribe on Acast too if you're on that app as well. But until next time, it's a goodbye from Beth, the Swedish Valhund of Swindon.
Thanks. Bye.
And from Sam, the Wolfhound of Woodford.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me, your very own Sussex Spaniel, Jay Cameron. Goodbye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.